you know, up to, I think, 1,000 or more were going to be disenrolled, de-enrolled. I haven't seen anything from the university about what that final number was. But if you didn't, if you don't want to be disenrolled, you don't have to actually go get vaccinated. You could just say that I refuse to get vaccinated and I will be tested. The problem with that is the testing is, you know, some schools are testing all their students. Brown University, for example, is testing all its students, whether they're vaccinated or not, twice a week, because they really want to know what the extent of COVID is on their campus. LSU is not doing anything like that. And so if you're, if you choose not to be vaccinated, you're not going to be tested enough that I think it's going to, you know, annoy you or inconvenience you to the point that you're going to want to go get vaccinated. And that's what schools that I think are taking it seriously are doing. They're raising the stakes, and LSU's not really raising the stakes that much on students who choose not to get the shot.
877-217-5757 to talk with Bob Mann, and we will cover some more ground with him. But I went to the LSU game Saturday night against McNeese, and I was checked to see if I had my vaccination information with me. But others, including Kyle Coates, who works for me, says he got right in without showing any proof. It appears to be an uneven process.
Yeah, the Advocate had a good story about that, and I saw a number of people on social media on Saturday night saying they didn't have their either they didn't have their vaccination records checked, or that they knew of people who were who were showing someone else's vaccine card and getting in. So yeah, it is spotty. And LSU admitted that they had some bugs to work out. So hopefully they will do that. But I think it's also important to note that for attending class and staying enrolled in the school and attending these games, you only have to prove that you had one shot. You can get the shot 5 minutes before you go into the game. And you're not fully vaccinated when you had one shot 5 minutes earlier. So there's this false sense of security that I think arises out of all that, that we have to be aware that a fully vaccinated person is a person who's had all his or her shots within at least 2 weeks ago. And that's not the case here at LSU by a long shot, I don't think.
Well, as Southern states go, we're rather progressive on vaccines, largely because of Governor John Bel Edwards, who will be doing his monthly radio show, Ask the Governor, today at 2 o'clock right here in Mississippi. Our neighboring state, Tate Reeves, reacted angrily to the coronavirus mandates for the vaccine from President Biden, saying it's terrifying. Yet this is in a state that Tate Reeves oversees that requires children to be vaccinated against measles, mumps, 7 other diseases to attend school, and goes even further than that by barring parents from claiming religious, philosophical, or conscientious exemptions. And Tate Reeves has said nothing about that. Is this another case of in which people are trying to make political hay over something that is far more serious than that?
Yeah, I believe so. Because I mean, you know, there's a dozen or more vaccines that everybody that most people get and give can make sure their children, including their very young children, get those vaccines. And there's, you know, it's never become politicized until, or widely politicized, I should say, until last year. And so I think it's, you know, it's, I think we're, as you mentioned, we've got a governor who takes this seriously, and we've got a president, by the way, who's taking this seriously and realizing that there is no argument out there that's going to persuade people who are just hell-bent on not getting vaccinated to change their minds, that these mandates are necessary and they work, and people are going to start getting vaccinated because there's not an argument that would persuade someone to do something that they don't want to do. And if you're going to lose your job or get vaccinated, you're probably going to get vaccinated.
And I would encourage Governor Reeves of Mississippi to, if he's so concerned about health, to get in shape. He's obviously a guy who could shed a few pounds and set a better example for the South, which largely is obese. So Tate Reeves, shape up or ship out. 877-217-5757 for Bob Mann. We're going to go to the phone lines in a moment, but obviously in California last night, a major development with the governor there, Gavin Newsom, holding on and doing so resoundingly, even getting a bigger margin of victory than he received when he was elected 3 years ago. He'll be up for re-election next year, and I think the people who fought him may end up ruining the day because they basically created a national figure out of this guy. And if ever a governor looks like he came out of central casting, unlike Tate Reeves, Gavin Newsom does, Bob Mann.
Well, yeah, and I think more importantly, Jim, the thing that this that recall episode showed Democrats is that they can run successfully against efforts to undermine COVID protocols, that that they can also frame elections as a referendum about Donald Trump and win them. Now, this was California, and it was overwhelmingly Democratic, but I think there's some lessons to be learned for Democrats in framing elections as a referendum about do we want to go back to the days of Trump and the people who the cult that builds around him, or do we want to move forward with more progressive policies? And I think that was a pretty smart framing of that. Instead of making it about Newsom or some better Democrat, they made it about Newsom or Trump. And, the Trump supporter, Larry Elder, and others lost overwhelmingly in California last night. It wasn't even close.
877-217-5757. Gavin Newsom, by the way, used to be married to Kimberly Guilfoyle, who was a Fox anchor, who's now the girlfriend of the much younger Donald Trump Jr. And I mentioned that I regularly get emails from President Trump, former President Trump, and now I'm getting them from Kimberly Guilfoyle. She says, Jim, did you see the president's email? He asked you to become an official Trump cardholder, but I just had to inform him that you haven't accepted his invitation. It's not too late to change that. Please contribute $45 by 11:59 p.m. tonight to claim your personalized official Trump card. That is from the girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., Bob. Obviously, the Trump family, they know how to work the system. I don't get many emails from the president of the United States, the current one.
Yeah, and it is odd that, it feels like the Trump organization is not really so much a political organization, but a fundraising organization disguised as a political organization.
All right, we do have to take a break, and we'll return in 90 seconds with more Pearls of Wisdom from Bob Mann. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, one of the most decorated writers in Louisiana, a man who's written about politics and also has written books about the American political scene, about the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the 1964 presidential election, and he wrote a biography, one of the best, about Ronald Reagan. 877-217-5757 to talk with Bob Mann. Please be brief. Kelly on I-10. Kelly, we start with you. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Bob. Question, observation. A number of fairly mainstream, credible physicians and healthcare professionals have confirmed that the viral load, the COVID viral load that, exists in people that are vaccinated is roughly the same as the COVID viral load of those unvaccinated. So that, says to me that vaccinated people can carry it and spread it at this point pretty much the same way. What are y'all's thoughts, or what are you reading about that?
All right, Bob, do you want to bite on that? Thank you, Kelly.
Well, I can't challenge that because I don't know that. I've seen some stories about that, and I think there may be some conflicting information about that. But I think that the point that I would make is that if on this campus or any place else, if you've had a shot or one shot, you've not completed your regimen, you're not fully vaccinated, you still have a much higher chance of getting COVID and spreading COVID. And I think we know that we're seeing stories of breakout infections of the fully vaccinated. So we can't let our guard down, especially in places where we're crowded together, like college classrooms and other places. And we have to. So I think these mask mandates make a lot of sense because we're clearly not going back to a lockdown. So we have to live smarter.
Henry at the Country Club. Henry, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Well, good morning, Mr. Bob. Good morning, Mr. Jim. Mr. Jim, I'm disappointed in you. You had to get ratted out by the girlfriend. But I want to give a little quick testimonial about Mr. Bob. I got on Amazon, ordered Mr. Bob's book. My book showed up in my mailbox the next day. It showed up faster than my credit card got charged. I want to tell him I appreciate that. My copy was even signed.
All right. Well, Henry, Bob is all smiles, I'm sure.
We aim to please. We aim to please, Henry.
Yeah, I guess he was talking about Kimberly Guilfoyle. So
that's
an unusual couple, but, you know, politics makes strange bedfellows. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Bob Mann. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. McConnell was quoted yesterday as saying that the Republican Party in the Senate is unified regarding not voting to increase the national debt ceiling. And most of the debt, or much of it, was put there by the Republican tax cuts for multi-billion-dollar corporations and billionaire individuals. What chutzpah the Republican Party has, they are so determined to hurt President Biden, they will actually destroy this country's credit and cause many other financial woes just to somehow hurt the president. It is totally despicable. They care more about themselves than they do about the country.
All right. Bob, would you respond to David?
Well, I think the larger point about that is that we're one of the only countries that handle our debt this way. You know, we vote on the spending, we incur the debt, and then months later we have a separate vote on whether to actually honor the debt that's already been incurred, and that's just crazy. We shouldn't do that, and there's no good reason to have this separate vote on raising the debt ceiling when the Congress votes to appropriate the funds. That ought to be part of the deal, and we could easily do that, but we choose to have this political crisis every year or two and allow one party or the other to hijack the political system and blackmail the president or the party in power, and that appears that what's lining up to happen in the next few weeks.
Yeah, well, I think David made a good point that Republicans care only about debts when they're not in office. And the record shows that Democrats have been far better at addressing the deficit, which contributes to the debt, than have Republicans. It was William Jefferson Clinton.
Yeah, while Trump was out of office, you didn't hear much about the debt, and now you hear it again. I think people should stop and think, why is that?
Well, the debt went from $12 trillion to $20 trillion when Obama was president, and then went from 20 to 28 when Trump was president, and he was there only 4 years rather than eight, and there was very little said about it, and now there's this great concern about it, and there should be. But let's be consistent, folks. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you, Mr. Mann. I'm wondering, it's just so difficult to imagine all the deaths that are occurring every day. I wonder if we could see these people, see the dead, see how many actual people are. I know we don't get to see the dead bodies of our soldiers, but I think that it would really pack a punch if people could see all these casualties, all these Americans that are dying.
All right.
Well, there's something to that. I mean, what's the saying about, you know, that somebody observed about the Holocaust, that 6 million deaths is a statistic, but one death is a tragedy. And I think that there is something about the particular, and I see these stories, we see them on the news every night, of people who didn't get the vaccine or are dying or have died and are begging for the vaccine as they go on the ventilator. And, you know, you would think that those stories would persuade more people to get vaccinated, but it doesn't seem to be working. And I think the only thing that ultimately is going to work is if you are not allowed to attend school or show up at your workplace and perhaps lose your job because, or fly on an airplane or whatever, because you don't get vaccinated. The mandates seem to be the only thing that's going to reduce this stubborn resistance by about a quarter of our population to get this life-saving vaccine.
I mentioned Bob's book, which is out and about, Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. And it is a book that is from Pelican Publishing, and it's not all champagne and roses. He basically takes a strong view of himself in many instances, something that is rare for people who are writing autobiographies. I'm reading Kathleen Blanco, and her reign is certainly pertinent in this time, since we've had these terrible storms that have affected our state dramatically. You say, by early 2006, my effectiveness as Blanco's communications director was over. She and Coach blame me for her poor public image in the wake of Katrina. Most people probably don't realize that, Bob. Your thoughts? Did we silence Bob?
Jim, you went out on me for about that last 5 seconds. Do you mind repeating the question?
Yeah, as far as the Blanco family, the coach and the governor, not being happy with you after Katrina.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think politicians in general, when they get into a bad stretch, they tend naturally, we all do, to look at our PR and suggest that maybe it's not bad policy, but bad PR. And I don't totally disagree with that. Under Katrina, as I write in the book, I think I could have done a better job at helping her present herself to the public and to show the true resolve that she had and what she was really doing to help Louisiana. And I blame myself for not helping her. And so it was probably best that she found someone else to handle her PR. I don't think that it really changed the trajectory of Katrina, but people are entitled to have the people they want around them doing that kind of work.
You also note that you started your career as a working journalist, and very early in your career, there was a governor's election in 1983 in which Edwin Edwards was attempting to come back and unseat Dave Treen, which he did successfully. And at the age of 24, you had unusual access with him, even riding in the same car. How was that experience?
Well, for a kid who really loved politics and was fascinated by politics and political campaigns, it was great. I mean, it was me and Edwin Edwards and a staffer driving him around for weeks at a time. And I had a lot of, time with him to talk to him and observe him and learn about him. And it was eye-opening, and it was one of the more interesting periods of my life to see a political campaign up that close. It was before really everybody else was following him around. The race hadn't really totally heated up, so I had this unfettered access for weeks, and I learned a lot about Edwin Edwards that I don't think I would have learned by just observing him at rallies and press conferences. So it was a priceless experience.
Good things and bad things. You saw him pursue women, didn't you?
Well, I did. I saw him. I did. I saw some bad behavior there, and I kind of regret not writing about it. Although he didn't exactly make that a secret, so I'm not sure it would have scandalized anybody that Edwin Edwards was had an eye for the ladies. But yeah, I did see some.
All right, we're going to spend a few more minutes with Bob Mann when we return after the break. The book is Backrooms and Bayous. We'll hear from Dr. Juco Holliday. Now this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we have a few more minutes with Robert Mann, the professor at LSU. His book is Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics, and then we'll go to the West Coast and hear from Dr. Juco Holliday, who's been with us a few times, but it's always a pleasure to catch up with her. Bob Mann, as I said, this is one of the most introspective autobiographies I've read, and I like the fact that you're willing to point a critical eye at yourself, and it is impressive that you've done so, but you do it of others, and that's good too. And a lot of times we read these books and it's just a bunch of Pollyannish stuff that is more PR than journalism. But Edwin Edwards, the most complex of all Louisiana figures, you're riding in the car with him, 24 years old, covering the campaign, unusual access. And at one point he got frustrated with you and said, F you. What prompted that?
I don't remember the question. I do remember it was in Shreveport, and I don't remember what I asked him, but he didn't like it. But he just turns around and just wheels around in the car. I'm sitting in the back seat. He says that to me, and he just sort of laughs and turns around, and we ride on. And he knew I couldn't quote him, and in those days you couldn't even write F-U. I mean, you just couldn't get away with that in a paper. So, he knew what he could get away with. And so it was kind of interesting that he was, I didn't take it as a hostile thing. I just took it as more of a, like, I'm just not going to answer the question, and I'm going to answer it in a way that you can't quote. And that was, he had a really interesting way of dealing with the press and with critics. I write in the book about how people would show up on the campaign trail with copies of Clyde Bedreen's scandalous book, just taking orders, and would hand the book to Edwin and ask him to sign it. And if it had been me, I would have treated it like a poisonous snake. And instead, Edwards, takes the book and scribbles his name in it and signs the book and all good humor and everything. And, he didn't take himself all that seriously, which I think was one of the secrets to his mm-hmm. success.
Well, he didn't hold grudges for the most part, but one he did hold was Clyde Bedreen, who wrote that book about him.
And he should have.
And when Clyde died, tragically shot to death outside the courthouse in Shreveport, I remember calling Sid Moreland and asking if the governor wanted to comment. And he came back a few minutes later. He says, yes, the governor has a statement for you, and I'm rolling the tape. Sid Moreland says, here's the statement. Merry effing Christmas. That was what he said about the death of Clyde Vidrine. Barry in Mid-City, you're on with Bob. Barry, you're on with Bob. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and good morning, Bob. I am wondering, please, if Bob could explain why the Louisiana congressional delegation could not have done more to get the aid to Lake Charles so desperately needed over the past year and a few days, please.
That's a great question, Rabbi. And you know, I was over in Lake Charles a few weeks ago speaking to the Rotary Club, and they were asking me the questions because they knew I'd worked on Capitol Hill. And I told them honestly, I said, you've got a clown as your congressman. You've got someone in Clay Higgins who has no respect when he walks through the halls of Congress. No one takes him seriously. He is a terrible advocate for you, and he's getting you nothing. And you know what? I didn't get much, really no pushback. I think they recognize that. But I think, you know, the difference between Katrina and Laura, for Lake Charles at least, was the difference in the congressional representation. And also, you know, to her credit, Kathleen Blanco went to Washington a dozen times to demand that aid that we eventually got. And that makes a difference when you've got leaders representing your state who are respected in Washington. And Clay Higgins and John Kennedy and others in our delegation are not that well respected and don't have the stroke to get things done.
Well, Bob, man, always good to catch up with you. Let's keep it going. And congrats on a really revealing book, Backrooms and Bayous. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks so much, Jim.
And we're joined now by Dr. Juco Holliday, joining us from the Golden State. 40 million American citizens call California home, meaning one out of eight people in our country lives in California. And Dr. Holliday, it was a big night in California for one Gavin Newsom, who held on as governor. And I did correspond a bit with Juco Holliday yesterday, and she told me that she is declined to state voter, which is how it's termed in California, not registered with a political party. But your thoughts about the ill-fated recall effort of Governor Newsom?
Oh, Jim, it is so good to speak with you. Thank you for having me here. I believe that I wanted to say that this is the second time that I participated in a recall election. So I was a Californian in 2003 when Gray Davis was recalled, and I actually supported his recall. I don't think I voted for Arnold Schwarzenegger, but the argument just wasn't there to remove Governor Newsom from power. Despite the pandemic, our economics are actually pretty astounding. We had the largest tax rebate in American history. So we had a $75 billion surplus and a $12 billion tax rebate. So the economy, despite the pandemic, is working. Our death rate per capita in terms of the pandemic is the best of any highly populated state. So the argument just wasn't there. And I think when someone like Larry Elder, who is a very extreme personality, emerges as a front runner, it was just flatly rejected because people who want to solve problems aren't interested in extremism on either side. Right? So,
Dr. Holliday, by the way, is a mental health practitioner, a yoga therapist and teacher, and she lives in California, has a minimalist lifestyle, and was affected by wildfires. She and her husband lost their home, and we will talk about that. But we had Bob Mann on earlier, who teaches at LSU, and he noted that your alma mater of Brown University is requiring students to be tested twice a week. How's the vaccine mandate, if you will, going in California right now?
Well, we don't have the same sort of strong reactions against vaccine mandates here. We didn't have a strong reaction against masking here. People are still voluntarily masking before a second mandate came for indoor activities right now. And, you know, I'm someone whose business was closed in March because of COVID. And I think that in aggregate, the way that I look at it is that if putting on a mask is helpful, fantastic. If it doesn't work, then we've suffered worse sort of constrictions. We just see it in a different way. Again, our hospitals right now, after a small surge right after the vaccine came out, our ICUs aren't full. Our rates of COVID among kids isn't surging. And, you know, what we have been doing seems to be working. And so I think when people see that, we don't take as big of an issue with it. Certainly there are people. I live in a very small a mountain community, a rural community, actually in the Santa Cruz Mountains, right along the edge of the Bay Area. So there's a mixture here of sort of mountain conservative folks and progressive tech folks. So it's a really interesting place to be. But at the end, we just are a community of people who come together. And there isn't the same sort of passionate feelings against trying to do the best we can to respond to the pandemic.
Well, in many ways, you're the quintessential Californian. You were raised in the Midwest, went to college on the East Coast, but came to California, fell in love with it, been there, I guess, about half your life or more. First in Southern California, now up the coast, and you, like many others, far too many, were affected dramatically, tragically, by wildfires last year. What happened, Dr. Holliday?
Well, I think historically, in context, it is a result of sort of the extreme clear-cutting of forests 100 years ago. So you can't take out a redwood canopy. I lived in a redwood forest. And then when everything that grows up in the wake of removing the canopy creates the kind of fuel load that we have, you can't then swing to the other extreme and say, don't cut down anything, right? Huh. So that those kind of decisions and the climate. So we had a horizontal roll cloud, which is like a horizontal tornado, came in off of the coast, and the fire that destroyed my home and, I mean, everything I couldn't fit on the back seat of my car was called the CZU Lightning Complex Fire. And, I had 15 minutes. I put my dog and my husband and our go bag in the car, and we were luckily not trapped on our forest property. We were able to get out. And a year out, I'm still in transitional housing. I have an incredible community. My landlord cut my rent because of COVID. So that's how I've been able to keep my business open, and then has allowed us to stay in the residential section of this commercial property that we rent. And so it has been harder than the hardest thing I've ever done. And I think that it kind of speaks to the frustration with the recall. I think that most of us feel like we just don't have time to waste $300 million when we have an election next year, considering the scale of the crises we're facing. And again, you know, Larry Elder said in his confession speech that, you know, he would concede gracefully, but that their side was going to win the war. And I think that those of us who, like me, have these Midwestern values and are attracted also to the culture here in California that still is kind of do your thing and be yourself, we understand that there is no war among us. The war is not between ourselves. We are longing to move away from that and to kind of see the community that I definitely saw. I visited and did kind of a renegade relief trip in the wake of Katrina. I was there when Rita hit. And the same sort of sense of help and seeing that we're humans first was evident then in Louisiana.
We're going to take a short break and return for a few minutes with Dr. Holliday, and then we'll hear from sports agent Oscar Schoenfeld after this brief time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Dr. Juco Holliday. Alondra Villarreal is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. We'll turn the page and hear from Oscar Schoenfeld as we close out the hour. But Dr. Holliday, as we hit the break, was talking about experiencing a wildfire last year in California and losing everything, at least all her material possessions, and had 15 minutes to get out, she and her husband did. And she was here after Hurricane Katrina and during Hurricane Rita in 2005. And as a psychotherapist, I think you can relate to the fact that fire and water are two different things, but the aftermath of these tragedies often brings out the best in people, Dr. Holliday.
It absolutely does. And I think that it is a really powerful reminder that we're in this together. We are in these crises that we're facing bring out our humanity. That's what I witnessed when I was in Louisiana after Katrina helping, and that's what I have definitely experienced a year out from the fire that took everything all my material possessions, as you mentioned, except for what we could fit on the back seat of our car. And I think and I hope that that's the spirit that can continue to emerge. I think I was tying that into the recall election. I mean, people are exhausted by being provoked. Larry Elder, who was the front runner, was in radio for a long time and was very much a provocateur. And I just think people are tired of being afraid. Right?
You think he was a provocateur?
Oh, well, I was being polite.
Yeah. Well,
I was being polite. Yeah. And I think people are tired of being provoked and we're ready to solve problems.
Well, JUCO Holliday, it's good to catch up with you. Let's talk again soon. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. Take good care. Yeah, thank you. You too. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
We're joined now by Oscar L. Schoenfeld III, and many who drive down Perkins Road see his office, and he is one of the best-known sports agents in America. He is a guy who's been a professor of law at the LSU Law School, taught sports law from 2000 to 2015, actually also served on the Louisiana Boxing and Wrestling Commission for 4 years. Some of his former clients include NFL players Willie Williams and Rufus Porter, NBA players Urban Johnson, Stanley Roberts, Darvin Ham, Mark Davis, Tim Bro, Damon Jones. He's been around. He's written about his life and times and sports agent, Up the Mountain and Down. And before we get to that, he has a compelling backstory, and we were slated to visit with him a few months ago, and he got the call that day. And the call that day in Durham, North Carolina, was it's time for your heart transplant, Oscar. And how's it gone? How's the comeback been, Oscar Schoenfeld?
Well, the comeback has been slow but progressive, and I just thank God for getting me through that. It was 4 years since my diagnosis with a rare heart disease that basically put me into heart failure. And I went to the internet and basically it's called TTR amyloidosis. And I looked to see, how do we take care of this? You have to get a stent or something. And the only thing it said was transplant. So it kind of shakes up your world. You think, I've been working out swimming for 20 years and I thought my heart was in great shape, but apparently God had a different plan. So at that point, I just had to kind of pray about it for a while, just accept it. And I'd been through a couple other surgeries the years before, and I was not anxious to go back in the hospital, and particularly with a massive surgery like that. But he gave me 4 years to get ready, and I basically kind of wind down my law practice, and things worked out for me well there. And I ended up back with my old office at 6513 Perkins. And then COVID hit and I came over here in North Carolina. I was going to Methodist as well as Duke. My cardiologist had wisely put me in two different spots. And I came over to North Carolina where I have a house near Asheville and basically came under the care of Dr. Patel at Duke. And he's a nationally known expert in this. And I've been seeing him for 4 years. And I came over here in March of 2020 because I had the heart condition and the COVID. And basically, I thought I had maybe another year because both my daughters are actually getting married in the next 4 or 5 months. So I really wanted to make it through that before the heart transplant. But in March, I got a bad reading on a heart cath. And they just basically said, we've never let anybody walk out of the hospital with your readings. So I felt like the time was there. And I got in the hospital, I think, April 14th. And I was in there 40 days, literally, waiting for a heart. I had one call up that didn't go through, and Duke was an amazing spot, and the doctors were great, and the nurses were great, but it was a long time, and I got the the heart transplant, I guess, May 25th. So I guess that's probably when we were supposed to meet. I remember that call, yeah, that day. And I can tell you, I've never been through anything like that in my life. And grateful to get out. And now I'm on, you know, several drugs to prevent rejection of the heart. And unfortunately, those make you immune compromised. So now the COVID, I'm even more susceptible. And something that a lot of people don't realize or appreciate is that immune compromised people, the vaccines may not work. Over 50% of them, mm-hmm. probably not. And so I've got to be very careful. But thank God I'm through that. And then when I found out I got the diagnosis, I'm basically... thought, you know, I may not be here in a few years. I just got to put it in God's hands. And that's what I did. But, you know, I went ahead. I said, I think I'll write a book. I've got some great stories that people love to hear from sports. And, you know, I've been telling them over the years. And I had some great clients and developed some great relationships. And so I sat down and wrote this book. And now it took me 3.5 years.
All right. Well, hold on. You're on a roll. And, Bill Huey writes, saying CNBC reports that more than 50,000 athletes are signed to NIL deals, name, image, likeness. And he says, is that a good thing or is it perhaps too soon, too fast? What do you think?
No, I don't think it's too soon, too fast. I think it's been long overdue. I think that these kids have come up here and worked hard and they should be able to, you know, benefit from their name, likeness, and images. I write about it in my book, which, by the way, you can get at sportsagentbook.com. I've got the website there, sportsagentbook.com. You know, I write in my book about the evolution of this. I mean, there's been a number of court cases going on over the last 4 or 5 years, and I do put a lot of legal background in my book since I'm a lawyer, and I had a lot of unusual legal proceedings with some of my clients, particularly Stanley. I focused on him a lot because he had a lot of good stories, let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. But no, I think it's been long overdue. And I think if you look back, even Coach Brown, who I've been in contact, and he's been giving me some inspiration during this time. He, in the 1980s, I think, wrote a list of, you know, 30 things the NCAA could do. And I think almost over half of those have been enacted since then. So I think it's long overdue, and as long as it's not abused, and I mean, it's going to be hard to differentiate. I think the NCAA is going to have to come up with something. What is a, you know, legitimate endorsement or use of likeness as opposed to just paying people? But, you know, I don't know if I talk about this in the book, but the NCAA, I mean, back in the 40s, I mean, players did get paid, and there were some problems with that. And it was in the 1950s that Byers, then the new head of the NCAA, they had a workman's comp case and they didn't want to pay the player. So they said he was an independent contractor and a, quote, amateur athlete. So that's where that phrase kind of originated. And I don't see, and I think why the coaches particularly. And
all right. I do want to get to some of the questions from our listeners. Cindy on government asks, what makes a good professional agent? There are a lot of them who call themselves such, and some do it well, others do it really well, and some don't do it well at all. What makes a good one?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to have an ability to negotiate. You have to have also you have to be able to talk to people and work with people and like different people. You know, I got to say, it's probably one of the most cutthroat and competitive fields that you can get into. And it's very, very hard to get into. And I just didn't realize when I got in there, I was able to sign 2 first-round NBA picks, Stanley, then Irvin Johnson, within 3 years, which was kind of a miracle, which I realized after the first 3 or 4 years. And frankly, I was a very good trial lawyer, and that's where I made my money. And I was looking at the agent as perhaps doing it full time, but that's kind of when I was making the journey. I called the book Sports Agent Up the Mountain and Down, because I kind of went up the mountain of maybe doing this professionally, but I got at the top a little bit. And then I realized, man, I cannot compete with this and be a lawyer also. And just some of the things that, happen to you as far as, you know, the cutthroatness and the competitiveness, unethical things that happen, it is as rough as it says. I mean, the movie Jerry Maguire is kind of based on Lee Steinberg, whose book I've read and is very good. But and, you know, that tells a lot of it. And so it's a tough agent. If you got to really love it, obviously, and you got to really be able to go out and meet people and whatever. But I mean, the way it's happening now with the amount of money's involved, and I'm particularly talking about baseball and basketball and football. You know, there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that people don't realize. And that's kind of what I point out in my book. Again, at sportsagentbook.com. And I feature a lot of me, you know, and the fact that I was able to get Stanley was just a stroke of luck that I happened to.
All right, we do have to roll, but the book is Sports Agent, Up the Mountain and Down, from Oscar Schoenfeld. Signature support for Talk Louisiana is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.